You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, espionage in the chip industry. ASML accusing a former China-based employee of stealing confidential information. The second such breach in less than a year. We discuss.
Plus, are we there yet? Elon Musk says he needs until late this year to fix Twitter before handing over to a new CEO. We'll bring you the details.
And valuing the AI opportunity, we sit down with Sonia Huang, partner on Sequoia's capital growth team, for a look at the future of generative AI technology and the startups driving it. But first, we check in on the markets because, well, initially there was panic that retail sales were growing at almost the fastest clip in 2 years, up 3%. Does that mean inflation is going to be high too, but then the market decides to drive higher. And in fact, we closed at session highs on the Nasdaq up 0.9%. The bond market's more worried about the good data, and they're up some 6 basis points as they think the Fed's going to have to tackle that inflation. Interestingly, we got a bit of a sell-off in Chinese-related names at the moment. Maybe this is a bit more of a focus on what's happening in terms of geopolitics rather than what's happening in the macroeconomy in the US. Flip it on a gear. I'm going to delve into some of the micro stories. On the day, we had some significant rallies. I mean, notably, Roblox up 26%, best day since December 2020. Everyone was gaming over the holiday season, and also they were really adding those active users. Airbnb up 13%, best day since November 2021, really on a tear as well, as it seems as though the strength from 2022 is going to continue into next year, Ed.
Yeah, earnings are a real driver, and that's still the case after hours this Wednesday. These are the names I'm watching. Cisco forecasting sales in the April quarter will rise 11 to 13%, double what analysts were forecasting. That stock having a positive reaction. Twilio, of course, just gone through a second round of layoffs, but a surprise forecast for an adjusted profit, 18 to 22 cents per share for the current fiscal quarter. The street looking for a 2-cent loss. That a big surprise and boosting that stock by almost 13%. And then Roku, one that we haven't spoken about as much, Caro, up 11% after saying first quarter sales will be $700 million, slightly above street expectations. But there's been concern about how they're losing market share to everyone else out there and seem to be weathering the storm. The big story of the day in markets, but also geopolitically, was ASML. The Dutch chip equipment maker saw its US ADRs actually under pressure for most of Wednesday's session, but basically closing flat. What we know, the company disclosed that a former employee in China stole information. That's what was driving the narrative. Now, in the last 30 minutes, a breaking Bloomberg scoop, which gives us some more insight into exactly what that information, what that data was. Let's bring in executive editor Tom Giles, who has the details. Tom, what have we learned in the last 30 minutes?
We have gotten information about, we've gotten more information on exactly what was stolen. So this ex-employee, this China-based employee, took information from a data management system that's used internally to let employees collaborate on products. And the products in this instance are very expensive lithography machines that ASML uses, that customers use to actually make chips. It's very expensive equipment. It's these could be the size of buses and cost upwards of $170 million a piece. So it's very, very valuable information. And what this person took, we don't have the specifics, but we know where it came from. And it came from this like information sharing system called LifeCycle, LifeCenter.
Team Center, is that what it's called?
Team Center.
I mean, if this seems to be coming from the likes of Siemens, Tom, what's so interesting is that this is, what, the second time that we've seen such a breach from China being linked for ASML, and all of this just speaks to the tension around US and China, particularly in technology.
Yeah, you know, the US is doing everything it can to deprive China of the information and the technology it needs in order to become a force in chip making. It lags far behind the US in this critical technology, and the US is doing everything it can, and it has asked players in Japan and the Netherlands, which are some of the companies, including ASML, that make the most sophisticated equipment. If you don't have ASML on your side, it's really hard for you to come anywhere near the capabilities of the US and the West. And that's why ASML is so critical. It is one of the very few companies in the world that makes these lithography systems that the information was stolen about.
And using everything from EVs to military gear. Tom, as always, thank you so much for helping break down what is another great scoop coming from your team. Now, turning to another company that we're watching, just talking about EVs, and, well, the man that's behind one of the key ones, but he's also behind Twitter at the moment. Elon Musk spoke to the World Government Summit in Dubai earlier today and said he may need to rest, well, in fact, have the rest of this year to make things right at Twitter before handing off to a new chief executive officer. Just take a listen.
I think I need to stabilize the organization and just make sure it's in a financially healthy place and that the product roadmap is clearly laid out. So I don't know, I'm guessing probably towards the end of this year would be good timing to find someone else to run the company, because I think it should be in a stable position around at the end of this year.
Well, man who's followed his entire journey over at Twitter is one Kurt Wagner. And I feel like a lot of Tesla shareholders were a bit disappointed by that timeline. But what was the Twitter reaction?
Yeah, well, for me, having seen the poll that Elon Musk came out with at the end of last year saying, should I find someone, I think the expectation from folks is that this was going to happen a lot quicker than a full calendar year, right? But as he pointed out, he has really been dramatically trying to cut down on the costs at Twitter. He's still spending a lot more time physically in the building than I would have predicted when he first took over. So, he clearly doesn't feel like Twitter's in a place where he can hand it off to someone else. Now, I also think, let's be real, when he does find a new CEO, it's not as if he's suddenly going to disappear, right? This is someone who likes to be very, very hands-on with the companies that he has. But I do think that it's taking a lot longer. It will, it sounds like, take a lot longer than I had expected.
Kurt, as we do each and every day, we went to our audience and asked, what do you think Musk should be doing right now? Should he be doubling down on Twitter? Yeah. Should he go back to Tesla? These are the results. They kind of speak for themselves. 45% of respondents say, get a new CEO in ASAP. What I'm finding hard to pass is, what has he actually done there? What has he actually changed in what is a brief amount of time since taking over?
Well, we know that he has gotten rid of a lot of people, right? In terms of costs, they've cut well over half of the staff. They're not paying some of their bills. They're trying to renegotiate contracts with vendors. So, there are business things that he's doing to try and drastically limit how much money Twitter is spending. So that's one thing. From a product standpoint, it doesn't feel like there's been a ton. Of course, for those of us who use Twitter all the time, we've seen things like, the algorithm changes or the tweaks to maybe the types of things we see in our feed that we didn't before. But it's not as if there's been some major new product that none of us were expecting that's come out yet.
Yeah, well, I guess Twitter Blue, to a certain extent, you have the edit if you edit button if you subscribe for it. I'm going to ask you the difficult question, knowing full well none of us have an answer, but who could be a next CEO at Twitter?
Well, what's funny is that, I think we've heard and reported that there's kind of a search going on, or there was a search at the end of last year. But what's, you know, my read on this is that it's going to be someone who Elon is very close with already, right? I mean, he's not going to just hand this company over to someone that a search firm finds for him. It's going to be a trusted advisor. It's going to be a friend. And, you know, I think that list is probably relatively short. You see, you look at the people who have been helping out most at Twitter, which maybe gives you the best idea. There's people like David Sachs, right, who he knows from his PayPal days, the venture capitalist. Steve Davis, the president of The Boring Company, has been spending a lot of time at Twitter. Those are the types of names that I would be leaning toward. But again, it sounds like we have a lot of time before he's going to make that decision.
Kurt Wagner. Love having you on about it. Thank you so much. Meanwhile, let's stick on the theme of Elon Musk, because thanks to Tesla's 70% rise this year, that's the stock price, the billionaire is closing in on recapturing his title as the world's richest person, since, of course, he fell behind Bernard Arnault in December. But it may take a bit longer for Musk to actually overtake Arnault, who's, of course, behind LVMH. He disclosed, in fact, this week he gave 11.6 million Tesla shares to unnamed charitable causes between August and December of 2022. Now, the stock was worth about $1.9 billion based on closing prices on the days Musk donated the securities.
Earlier today, the SEC proposed expanding certain requirements to cover a range of assets, including virtual currencies. Bloomberg's Shanali Basak caught up with Coinbase's general counsel and chief legal officer, Paul Grewal, about how these changes will impact his company.
Coinbase, custody trunks company, is a qualified custodian today. It was a qualified custodian yesterday, and it will remain a qualified custodian tomorrow. And the reason for that is that in many ways, Coinbase has operated exactly in accordance with these rules. And we think that's good for the industry, and we think that's good for consumers and investors.
Against that backdrop, Paul, what do you make of these SEC chair comments that investment advisors can't necessarily rely on platforms such as Coinbase as qualified custodians?
Well, I think that when it comes to Coinbase, we've seen actually SEC officials explicitly recognize that Coinbase can and does operate as a qualified custodian in a safe, reliable manner that investors and consumers can have confidence in. As for others, we think standards are a good thing. We think that and investors and consumers have a right to understand that their assets are safe, that the standards that are being followed by those charged with that responsibility are standards that have been vetted by appropriate overseers and regulators. So in a lot of ways, this is about bringing the rest of the industry up to the standard Coinbase has set for itself. And on balance, we think that's positive.
But Paul, what does that then mean for something like international expansion? Well, at the end of the day, cryptocurrencies broadly are an international prospect. How does that translate?
They are. I mean, there's no question about it that one of the things that I think is has accounted for or led to so much of the interest in crypto is its borderless nature. But the fact remains that each jurisdiction has its own rules, and Coinbase, of course, follows those rules to the strict letter of the law. The thing is, though, that for many in crypto, the options to operate are truly international. What that means is that the United States needs to understand that its standards are, in some ways, competing against those of the rest of the world. And so, yes, we always want to make sure that investors and consumers are protected. Yes, we want to make sure that the standards are clear. But it's also important to strike the right balance between innovation on the one hand and protection on the other.
That was Coinbase's chief legal officer, Paul Grewal. Let's get into it with Bloomberg's Shanali Basak, who is a part of that conversation and brought us that interview. I guess the starting point is, what does that mean for Coinbase's business? How does this complicate things for them going forward?
Well, I think a couple things are interesting here, Ed. You have them clearing the record here and seeing them as a qualified custodian, even under these new proposed rules, that it's still unclear on how long they would take to become real rules, given the feedback that they're getting overall. member, even though you have Coinbase here kind of applauding certain parts of this process here. Coinbase has such a nuanced relationship with the SEC. They applaud certain parts of this rulemaking process, but remember, there are other things that they heavily dispute, such as some things that the SEC feels about staking. Even when it comes to this qualified custodian issue, remember, Coinbase is one. You have other members of the crypto community a little more concerned. Jake Chervinsky, for example, of the Blockchain Association, voicing his frustrations online about how these proposed changes could violate the SEC's mission by making investors less safe and discouraging capital formation. And I have to say, when you look at the other SEC commissioners that have weighed in, there are a number that have also voiced concerns about the amount of qualified custodians. What happens outside of Coinbase in this industry? Remember, both because Bitcoin was up over the 24-hour period, as well as some positive, frankly, regulatory news for Coinbase, you saw the shares just completely ripping today. But again, there are some things on the sidelines, like the staking issue, which remains to be unresolved.
Let's go outside the world of Coinbase, largely because my husband's a manager over there, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But I'm interested in your world outside. What are the ripple effects? What is, you know, crypto at large being reading into the SEC crackdown? Is it, where do the ripple effects go?
Well, outside of Coinbase, like I was saying, the reason this matters so much is because we've reported a couple of times this week that the SEC and other regulators have largely been whispering to the rest of the financial industry, saying that, listen, your relationship to crypto matters to you, and by the way, could open you up to more liabilities. So if you're a hedge fund, do you have to worry about how your assets are custodied? It's interesting because let's see how the next 12 months play out, because does that force these hedge funds like a Brevan Howard or others to start working with the likes of a Coinbase more? What happens to something like BNY Mellon? You have, for example, just a couple of days ago, Brian Armstrong talking about how institutional interest has grown in the space, even despite some of the crypto winter issues. But what happens as the SEC brings down a stronger arm on the industry? Do the traditional players start to get a little spooked is the main question.
And to take it full circle back to why the SEC is so rankled about crypto and why in many ways people are saying they're acting with hindsight is because of what happened with FTX. Bring us up to speed with what's happening with the founder of FTX. Sam Bankman-Fried has been all over the press today.
What a day. So this has been weeks where we knew that Sam Bankman-Fried, as well as his lawyers, have been trying to keep the name of the guarantors behind this really record-setting bail package, this bond, this $250 million bond, secret. But now we have the judge really saying that this doesn't apply to these particular instances because these guarantors decided to be involved in such a public case. Mm-hmm. These are two people that are very closely related to the parents of Sam Bankman-Fried. Remember, this is Barbara Fried and Joseph Bankman, who have been Stanford Law professors. Remember, this is one of the people involved in the guarantor program here is Larry Kramer, who was a Stanford Law Dean, a legal historian alongside Barbara Fried for a very long time. And if you take a look at the statement here, really, he makes it very, very personal. He has nothing to say about the legal matter itself, but his family has faced a harrowing battle with cancer, he says, and the Bankman-Fried family has been the truest of friends. And so this is a very personal matter for him to show up for the Bankman-Fried family in their time of need, according to his statement provided to us on Wednesday. Tomorrow, Thursday, Sam Bankman-Fried does face court in New York again to discuss his bail conditions. Remember, there have been a lot of questions about how he's been communicating with people via Signal and other means in the course of his house arrest here, where he is living with his family on essentially what is land and property owned ultimately by Stanford as well.
I'm sure you'll be keeping us up to speed with all that happens in that court tomorrow. Shanali Basak, we thank her. Meanwhile, sticking with oversight, the CEOs of Apple, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, well, they've all been subpoenaed by the House Judiciary Committee. Chair Jim Jordan is seeking more information from the tech giants on content moderation. Now, the subpoenas require Sundar Pichai, Andy Jassy, Tim Cook, Mark Zuckerberg, and Satya Nadella to respond to the committee with documents and communications by March 23rd. We do not know if there will be an in-person hearing, Ed.
Thank you, Karen. Now, coming up, Apple pushing back its long-awaited debut of its mixed reality headset. We bring you the Bloomberg Scoop. That's next. Before we head to break, I'm checking in on Roku. Call underway. Shares continuing to push higher, up almost 11%. Forecasting revenue of $700 million in the fiscal first quarter, above expectations. I'm looking at commentary on the call from Anthony Wood, CEO, Steve Loudon, CFO, saying 2022, very tough year, but the outlook going forward a bit brighter. And on that adjusted EBITDA basis, they're moving towards positivity 2024. We'll continue to track that stock as the call's ongoing. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Let's talk about Apple and a setback for the company. Its next big initiative, according to people familiar with the matter, the tech giant is postponing that planned introduction of its first mixed reality headset. It's going to go to June instead of April. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, of course he did. Of course he had the scoop for us. Just talk to us a little bit about, well, what's having to put the brakes on here?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me as always. So this is the latest incarnation of the status of Apple's long-awaited mixed reality headset. They wanted to get it out the door in about this time last year. They pushed it back to the end of last year, then to January of this year, then to April of this year. Now it's being postponed yet again to early June at the annual Worldwide Developers Conference, right? That's WWDC. This makes a lot of sense. This is Apple's big showcase every early summer, late spring, where they introduce their next platforms, their next software updates for all the devices. So it makes sense to showcase this device there too.
I get that. I get the marketing decision. But was that what drove it, according to our sources? Did they basically say, you know what, let's wait for the big splash? Or in looking at the products, was it just that there were issues, it wasn't ready? What have you found out?
I'm sure it was a blend of both. Obviously, Apple's a very marketing and PR-driven company, so I'm sure that had a big role to play in it, but this was mostly an engineering-based decision. There were quite a few issues related to both hardware and software on the device, and maybe a little bit attributed to production as well. So it made sense to push it back, keep it in the oven for a couple more months, and really have that introduction down correctly and have that gap in between when the product's introduced and released really stay in that initial time frame, right? Because if they introduced it in April, you know, they probably would have to push back the release by a couple months as well, because there were still quite a few snags to work through.
Pivoting from hardware to services, you had another story 24 hours ago about Apple's strategy when it comes to buy now, pay later. And it's changing how it makes decisions on basically lending to the consumer. What have you found out?
So this is actually quite interesting. So Apple will be doing lending for the first time. They'll be actually giving out these loans up to about $1,000 for buy now, pay later. This would be very similar to what Affirm and Klarna and some of the other providers do. And so what Apple will be doing is they'll be using all that data and that history they have on individual customers to make those decisions, to decide how much they want to loan a person. Maybe, you know, they look at your Apple Pay, right? How many cards you have on Apple Pay? Were you approved or denied for an Apple card? How many apps do you buy on the App Store? How much have you spent and then paid off in devices in the past?
Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. Just ongoing terrific reporting on Apple. Thank you so much.
If you think that that artificial intelligence is going to influence the enterprise in a big way, then I think this represents just a staggeringly large addressable market opportunity.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. You heard there, Carrie, the thoughts of C3AI CEO Tom Cebo on the show 24 hours ago. Let's carry on this conversation because it just won't stop.
Yeah.
Euphoria, the buzz around AI, it won't go away.
It won't go away. And I think what's notable is we're all thinking about the consumer use right now. What is the enterprise use? And I know that there's some big bets on the fact that there are going to be some killer apps out there, but not just for you and me, but the way in which we work and which we put this to a real productive endpoint.
Yeah, and those are some of the names that are continuing to raise funds as well. So let's get all of this under wraps with Sonia Huang, a partner at Sequoia Capital's growth team. She's co-led investments in AI-focused companies such as Gong, where Sonia's on the board, as well as Glean and Hugging Face. You can see some of the portfolio names there. Sonia, welcome. You set out a thesis in September, and in that thesis you said, here's where generative AI takes us by 2030. A lot has changed since September. Has any of what's happened accelerated what's possible and how soon it could happen to your mind?
Thank you so much for having me here. We think this is a watershed moment for technology. If we think about previous platform shifts, going from desktop to mobile, going from on-premise to SaaS, we think that this one is even larger in magnitude as a platform shift. I want to just take a moment to underscore the significance of what is happening right now in technology. We now have models that are capable of writing, of creating, of conversing at human or even superhuman levels of intelligence. That's something that computer scientists have been dreaming of since the 1950s, and it's finally arrived. And I think the impacts are going to be profound. Every industry is getting reinvented by AI. Neva and Glean are doing that with search. Gong is doing that with sales. Ironclad is doing it with legal. There's this Cambrian explosion of applications right now, because whenever there is a platform shift, it opens the door for founders to build new and daring legendary companies. And that's exactly the gold rush that we're seeing right now in the startup ecosystem.
You've called it a gold rush. Bloomberg, in some of its headlines, has called it a frenzy. There are publicly traded stocks, C3AI, Big Bear AI, that are up triple digits year to date. Is this overhyped or is the hype justified?
Look, I think there's hype and there's substance, and we try to separate the two. Hype comes and goes. It kind of creates this crazy animal spirits. You can't control it. And so for the better of our part, we try to ignore what happens with hype and focus on the substance. And when it comes to substance, it is just stunning to see some of the results in generative AI already. If you think about previous times when everyone got excited about AI, a lot of it was a head fake. This time is different. This time it's not vaporware. Everyone has ChatGPT in the palm of their hands. Everyone is using this technology. If you look at some of the results that are being delivered, GitHub has some results that they've published that 40% of lines of code are now being auto-completed by their model, Copilot. If you look at AI that can now generate entire screenplays and movies from scratch, the results are there. So we try to ignore the hype and focus on the substance. And when we see the substance of the results that are being created right now, boy, do we get excited.
And when you wrote in September that thought leadership piece, Sonia, what was interesting is you called it a large world Moore's Law. Dream for us, therefore. Already we've got ChatGPT on our hands. Where in the next decade does it take us? What will we be able to do?
Yeah, as we think about it, the pace of progress and R&D on the large models has just been breathtaking. And I think it's only going to accelerate. If you see all the announcements that Google and Microsoft have been made, there is an arms race happening right now as it comes to training and investing in these large models, both the algorithms and the compute and the data. And I think that benefits the entire ecosystem because all these applications rely on great foundational models. And as the foundational models get larger and larger, their emergent capabilities just are blowing everybody away, and I think that means a positive for the entire ecosystem. These applications are now capable of doing things that weren't possible before. Let me give you an example. Ironclad in our portfolio is a company that does legal contracting software. Now that GPT-3, 3.5, now we're getting on to GPT-4, is getting so good, it is finally becoming possible for us to automate away the creation and the analysis of legal contracts. These are the sorts of capabilities that get unlocked at the application layer when the foundational layer starts to get really good.
The previous answer you gave was about separating hype from reality. And the way in which you talk, it does, unfortunately, take me back a year or so when the hype was all around crypto. And I know you have nothing to do with FTX yourself personally, but Sequoia has itself embroiled in that in some way. And I'm interested as to how you think about the due diligence you do on AI and really understanding the value of these companies, because it must be really hard to understand when you're thinking of such explosive growth. How do you line up the valuations? How do you decide what checks you're going to write and where this company's future can go?
Well, I was an investor or a specialist in crypto, so I can't speak to that. What I can tell you is when it comes to AI, we are leaning into the approach that we always take, which is to find, each of us finds one or two companies that we really, really want to partner with every year. It's a very small number of companies. We're trying to find future category leaders. And then we are running down due diligence in order to understand whether the evidence lines up with the story. Right now, the story of these companies is incredibly promising when you think about the things that they're able to do. They're able to automate away the entire film creation process, the entire game development process. The burden is then on us as investors to go and make sure that the evidence lines up to the story. And that means talking to customers. That means looking at dollar retention rates to make sure that customers are finding value out of these products and that we're not just dreaming and hoping that they will see that value.
What's been so interesting about OpenAI in particular is its closed profit model. And a lot of emphasis has been on the investment from Microsoft into that business, but a question that has kept coming out of that is how do these companies monetize? Will they ever monetize to a level where they change the game economically speaking?
Well, first of all, OpenAI deserves a ton of credit for taking what happened with transformers and large language models and taking it out of the research labs of these big tech companies and turning it into a real arms race, and they have the results to show. GPT-3, GPT-3.5, ChatGPT, DALL-E, these results are stunning. To your question on business model, I actually think the business model is fairly straightforward. It is intelligence as an API. Just as we're in an API economy, just as you buy Stripe over API, you buy Twilio over API, a lot of the companies we're working with need to rely on these foundational models in order to run their goods and services. And a lot of them are looking to pay OpenAI for that. So the same way you'd pay for an API call to Stripe, you pay for an API call to OpenAI.
What's interesting around OpenAI, of course, has been the rapid pace at which we've suddenly seen everyone wanted to use it, 100 million within a week or so. It's also now, as they team up with Microsoft, they are trying to very slowly but surely get it into consumers' hands, people learning, iterating, improving with it. But unsurprisingly, humanity forces chatbots to the brink sometimes. And there has been some reporting around some of the inaccuracies or sometimes some of the extraordinary comments around sentient or not. To that point, how do you feel about some of the regulation or indeed focus on ethics that we're getting to in the point in artificial intelligence?
I think all of these questions are very real. They're very thorny. They're very hairy. Some of them are getting solved as we speak. So for example, the concept you were just talking about, hallucinations, which is that these models have the tendency to make up things on the fly, that's getting solved by these foundational model companies. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 6 to 12 months we have models that are actually capable of truthfulness. There's other questions over ethics, over copyright. These are sort of hairier problems that require all the stakeholders to get around the table and agree on what's fair. Is it fair for Stability to profit off the back of other artists' work? And Stability, for their part, has been a really good ecosystem player in, you know, collaborating and bringing artists to the table. I think these are all problems that are solvable in the near to medium term. I actually think long term about the economic impact. What happens when all these jobs start to get automated away? I think it has the potential to create a lot of disruption in terms of our labor force, in terms of the fabric of our society and the economy. And in that sense, I think it's incredibly important that we're all investing in reskilling to make sure that we are all able to make use of these new technologies and nobody is left behind. This is a rising tide here. We want the rising tide to lift all boats.
Sonia, it's interesting to see also names from China, Baidu, Tencent, kind of follow suit very quickly. Yeah. How interesting is the opportunity there? There's an initiative in Congress to kind of block access to investing into Chinese companies right now. Is that an area that you'll look to, the talent and innovation that's coming out of China in AI?
Yeah, absolutely. I focus on investments in the U.S. and Europe.
Right.
We as Sequoia are set up as three separate teams, U.S., Europe, China, and India, Southeast Asia. So I primarily focus on investments in the U.S. and Europe, where we're seeing a lot of investment and effort from the likes of Microsoft, Google,
yes.
OpenAI. I think that this will likely play out similar to cloud computing revolution, where you ended up with Microsoft Azure, you ended up with Google Cloud Platform, you ended up with AWS in the U.S. and then the Western world, and China has its equivalent clouds. I think a similar thing will play out in the foundational model world.
Absolutely fascinating. I can't believe they're called hallucinations. That's absolutely brilliant. Sequoia Capital Partner, Sonia Huang, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Wonderful to deep dive on AI there. Meanwhile, coming up, let's deep dive on Akamai, the shares falling after the infrastructure software company reported results that, well, show pressure from the cloud computing costs, the investment there. We're going to discuss it all with the CEO and co-founder, is Tom Leighton, joining us next. And Ed, you've got some breaking news.
Yeah, President Biden has done a surprise tweet, actually. In building our EV charging network, we have to ensure that as many chargers work for as many drivers as possible. He name checks to that end at Elon Musk will open a big part of that Tesla's network up to all drivers. Remember, President Biden naming Tesla and naming Elon Musk, that does not happen often. This is a story we'll continue to track. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Let's check in on the shares of Akamai Technologies. Look, they fell the most since May of last year after reporting results. That's as analysts started to note perhaps that the cloud computing costs are pressuring some free cash flow margins. Let's talk about why that investment is being made and what the future of the company is. Tom Leighton, he's a doctor. He's the Akamai CEO as well. It is great to have some time with you, Tom. Just talk to us about, it seemed as though analysts were a bit worried about the conservative nature of your forward-looking guidance, so the first quarter forecast. Talk to us about the shift to compute. Why will it pay off eventually? Because perhaps you're pulling back on as and when it will pay off.
Yeah, the compute market is enormous, well north of $100 billion a year. And Akamai is in a great position to tap into that market with our launch of Akamai Connected Cloud. You know, we already have a platform with over 4,000 locations doing edge computing where function as a service. And now we're integrating in Linode and growing it so that we'll have a core cloud compute functionality and a distributed compute functionality. So containers and VMs can get a lot closer to end users around the world. And by putting it all together, we're going to be able to offer major enterprises better performance for a lot of compute function at a lower price point. And cost is a big issue today with the cloud. And that's a place where I think Akamai can really help.
So when RBC's analyst says, you're going all in on compute, we would wait for evidence it can pay off before getting back involved in your stock. When can they get back involved? When will it pay off for you, do you think, Tom?
Well, I think now is a great time to get involved. You know, we obviously weren't happy with the sell-off today, but I think Akamai is at a great value now. And as we do the build-out this year and add the functionality, we'll be signing up more customers. You know, I've had the chance to meet with senior executives at many of the world's leading media companies, commerce companies, and they are very excited about being able to use Akamai Connected Cloud. You know, they care a lot about performance. They care about getting their apps close to end users, and they care about cost. And so I think you'll see increasing numbers of large enterprises start to adopt Akamai Connected Cloud, and then that'll translate into substantial revenue growth for Akamai down the road.
Tom, you mentioned costs. I think one specific complaint from the street I'd point out is they're worried about you taking on the likes of AWS and Azure on price. They, you know, RBC, for example, says that's a pretty tough value proposition. Is that your strategy, to take on the big boys when it comes to price?
Well, yeah, you know, we've been competing with the cloud giants for over 10 years, and we still have the market-leading delivery solutions and the market-leading security solutions despite competing with the hyperscalers. In fact, you know, the hyperscalers are some of our largest customers. They use those services from Akamai even though we're competing with them. And now we're going to compete on core cloud compute too. And, you know, I think it'll be a compelling value proposition for major enterprises. Also, it's good to realize we're not a threat to the hyperscalers. You know, we're going after a 1 or 2% market share over the next few years, which for us is huge. That's billions of dollars, which makes a big difference to Akamai. But, you know, they've got businesses that are growing 15% a year. And if Akamai, you know, manages to take 1 or 2%, that's not going to slow them down. So I don't think they're worried about, oh, they got a lower price to compete with Akamai.
You talked on the call about new segmentation customers. I just wondered if you could talk us through some of the areas where you feel you're winning. What kind of customers are they? What sectors are spending money with you right now?
Yeah, for segmentation, that's the companies that have you know, mission-critical functions, key infrastructure, banks, utilities, companies that can't afford to get be hit with ransomware. And increasingly, you're seeing the government authorities require a solution there. And Guardicore now is recognized as the market leader. So I think, you know, over time, pretty much every major enterprise is going to need that solution. But today, it's starting with, you know, mission critical infrastructure.
Tom Leighton, Akamai CEO, thank you for your time on a busy earnings day. And let's stick with earnings. Bloomberg caught up earlier with Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky post-earnings talking about robust travel demand. Here's what he had to say about where exactly the company is seeing any signs of that strength.
We are expecting pretty steady growth. Now, we are expecting a little bit more accelerated growth in short-term stays, but that's more of a recovery. We're seeing more recovery short-term stays. We're seeing more people go to cities, and we're seeing more people cross borders. Between urban and cross-border, that was around 80% of our nights booked before the pandemic. So it's really more a matter of a recovery of the old ways of traveling and a real sustainability of the new ways, like including people staying longer and traveling to more places.
Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky there.
Let's talk about UFOs and how they can help the US fend off Russia and China. In the past few years, the US has been a lot more willing to talk about UFOs, and for a very good reason. It's not that authorities want to talk about aliens.
But there is no, again, no indication of aliens or extraterrestrial activity.
They mean unidentified flying objects in the truest sense, something airborne that they can't identify. They prefer to call them unidentified aerial phenomena. The US breaks these so-called UAPs into five categories, according to a declassified report from 2021. Airborne clutter, such as birds, plastic bags, and civilian drones. Natural atmospheric phenomena, such as ice crystals or thermal fluctuations. US government or industrial development programs, which speak for themselves. Foreign adversary systems, including technologies allegedly deployed by Russia or China. And the fairly nebulous other.
That's the one that tends to excite people because it includes flying saucers and little green men. But it's the penultimate category, foreign adversary systems, that the government really cares about, which is why it's been trying to encourage the military to report UFO sightings. Navy or Air Force personnel might have felt embarrassed about reporting a potential UFO sighting for fear of ridicule. But some of those might actually have been spy balloons or drones from a geopolitical competitor such as China. If the UFO isn't reported, then the government may never know that a spy balloon has entered its airspace. The issue soared into the headlines when the US shot down what it said was a Chinese spy balloon in February and said it was part of a broader trend. If pilots report what they think are alien sightings more often, then it might help the US better identify actual threats from terrestrial rivals.
Bloomberg. Quick takes, Alex Webb there, and let's dig into this more. Ryan Hartman is president and CEO of Worldview. It's a company that focuses on remote sensing and stratospheric surveillance, and which has agreed to go public through a merger with a blank check firm. Ryan, stratosphere is a new economy. Explain that for us.
Well, I think what we've seen over the last few weeks is that the stratosphere is in fact a contested domain. And what that means is there's going to be nations all around the world that are using this kind of technology to deliver remote sensing or surveillance types of capabilities. And that's why we call it the stratospheric economy.
Ryan, can you give us any size and scope on how your business has been buffered by what's happened in the headlines of recent weeks? Are you winning new business because of this?
Well, we're certainly getting a lot more interest. And I think, you know, the timing of us taking the company public, you know, helps investors understand that, you know, this is an area where it's a great place to invest. There's certainly a lot more work to be done in the stratosphere. And it's not just government work, it's commercial work. You can do things like methane detection or monitoring power lines or other critical infrastructure. And so, you know, it's really exciting. You know, it's concerning as well to see those kind of technologies flying over our own country, but it's quite exciting.
Yeah, put your technology versus what we've seen out of China. How much more ahead of the game are they or not?
Well, you know, one of the key differences of our technology is the ability to navigate. You know, we're not going to fly over a country where we shouldn't be flying. Our technology enables us to maneuver quite freely. It enables us to stay over an area for a very long period of time. And so those are the things that are important.
Ryan Hartman, President and CEO of Worldview, will continue to track your company, I am sure. Now, that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Caro?
Yeah, sadly, I'm going to be off for the next couple of days. It's a time that schools shut down for a couple of days. But I know that you're going to do an amazing job. I'm going to be tuning in, Ed. And you don't want to forget to choose to listen to our podcast, too. You can find it on the terminal, go online on Apple, on Spotify, on iHeart, and our Twitter Spaces. I'm already going to start promoting that for Friday, midday. New York time. From New York, from San Francisco, this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.